You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Hi, Chris.
Hi, Bob.
How you doing?
So far, so good. How about yourself?
Are you sure you mean that? We actually had a certain amount of tech trouble before this. I really am not sure that we're starting this conversation off on an honest note.
No, you're fair enough. But I think so far, so good. It's more of a statement of process than of status, you know?
Yeah, I think if we look at it
not
that way.
Not committing prematurely to anything.
We'll yeah, I think. No, you've won me over to your way of looking at it.
All right, score one.
Let me introduce us. I'm Robert Wright. This is The Wright Show, available on both streaming video and via audio podcast. You're Chris Lehman, the quite new editor of the venerable New Republic magazine, or magazine is the word we used when I was at the New Republic, longer ago than I care to remember. And so I wanted to talk to you about, first of all, being the editor of the New Republic. And I maybe wanted to use my experience there occasionally for purposes of contrast, because as you may have heard, there have been technological changes since my day.
Do tell. Yes.
And I was actually, you know, I was actually acting editor for 7 months. So
when would that have been exactly?
That was from the end of 88 through like June of 89 when Mike Kinsley was on sabbatical at The Economist. It was my wife says that I have not been the same since that. That was not a good time.
I suspect my wife will take the same position.
Okay, well, we're going to talk about that.
Good.
We should also say that you've written a couple of books, The Money Cult.
Yes.
Right? And what's the other one, Rich People Things?
Rich People Things, yes, which was an outgrowth of an online column, speaking of new technologies.
You were the editor of the Baffler.
I was.
So this is your second editorship.
Technically my third, because going back to the mid-90s, I was editor of In These Times as well.
Whoa. I do want to get into ideology, and that certainly positions you as a man of the left.
Fair enough.
In these times, right? I mean, further left than the New Republic was when I was there.
No, I think that is true.
That which is not hard to be in a lot of ways.
Also true. But but yes, I think, you know, obviously, in addition to technology, American politics has changed considerably.
Quite so.
Particularly over the last, I would date it from 2008. You know, ideas that were once, obviously, I think, fringe on both, you know, broad sides of the ideological spectrum have become less so. There are costs entailed with that. There are also new opportunities and frontiers. And I often tell people, you know, who are perhaps taken aback by my intellectual background that, you know, going further back in the New Republic's past, you know, I will say this may not be your father's New Republic, but it might be your great grandfather's New Republic.
Henry Wallace.
And further back than that, Randolph Bourne, John Dewey, you know, people who were, very much part of a small D democratic left, when it meant something very different, you know, than it does today. But, my only point there is there is a left lineage in the New Republic. It's just not the one we tend to think of.
Absolutely. No, it's been a number of places. Of course, founded by Walter Lippmann and I guess Herbert Crowley and maybe somebody else in 1914.
Yeah.
And, and has been back and forth and has been a very important institution.
Absolutely.
A lot of pressure on you, man.
I'm not unaware of that. it is an interesting legacy. In fact, when I was in graduate school, the seminar room where my history department was, for some reason, was lined with all the back issues of TNR.
Really? And
I sort of couldn't stand whatever monograph I was then reading on shoe manufacturing in Western Massachusetts. I would go and page longingly through the back issues of TNR and feel like this is where the action is. So it is odd that I wound up in this position.
Yeah, we had all those in the editorial where we had our editorial meetings when I was there. Do they still have them? Do they still have the physical bound volumes?
Yes, they do, up in the main office, which is now in New York. They I assume, moved them up from D.C. around the time that the Chris Hughes purchase happened.
Chris Hughes did move them from D.C. Right. Yeah. And he, of course,
they're still there. We're actually reviewing them now because we're in the process, among other things, of embarking on a redesign of the magazine. So we're using past versions of TNR as key reference points in that project.
So the physical magazine is going to continue to be an important thing?
Absolutely. I'm a print guy from way back, both because I'm old and because I'm a nerd. And, you know, as Pascal said long ago, you know, all the trouble in the world stems from the inability of a man to sit alone in a room. And I usually put a book in that hypothetical person's hand. So yes, I do think print is, it's never going to go away. And I think it's, you know, in some ways its intellectual value is waxing. I think there's a greater demand as we're flooded by kind of bitlets of information and quick takes and instantaneous experience online for context, for, you know, I don't have to tell you, since you've been interested in evolutionary psychology, like the narrative impulse in human beings is pretty hardwired. Mm-hmm. So I think there will always be a place for print, certainly for longer analytical argumentative journalism.
Mm-hmm. So before we get into further into this question of kind of how you're looking at the future of the New Republic, tell us a little about yourself. You in an email disclosed that you're from the Midwest. What part?
I wouldn't lie about a thing like that. I'm from Iowa.
Iowa? Whoa.
Which is a part of the country you tend to see a lot around this time of a campaign cycle. In fact, I was joking in the office the other day, like, I'm now getting emails from Democratic presidential hopefuls saying how much time, you know, they're spending all their time in Iowa. Kamala Harris said she's going to move there. And I was like, don't they understand it took me the better part of 10 years to get out of there? Like, this is no great accomplishment from where I sit.
Now, so I spent some time in Iowa once. I remember a lot of rural territory. Were you,
fair enough.
What kind of family were you from? And also, there is a progressive strand in Iowa.
Oh, yeah. You probably remember from your time in TNR, at any given moment, Iowa would generally have the furthest right wing and furthest left wing senator. There would be Roger Jepson and John Culver and Chuck Grassley and Tom Harkin. That tradition goes far back. There is before the term populist became an epithet under the present administration, you know, there is an honorable rural populist tradition that is about empowering small producers and fighting back against trusts and big corporate interests. And to answer your question more specifically, I Davenport is the third largest city in the state. So by Iowa standards, it's a metropolis. It's about 100,000 people. It had formerly been the farm implement manufacturing capital of the world, with John Deere across the river in Moline, International Harvester, Caterpillar, Alcoa, all had major operations there if they weren't in fact headquartered there. And it was laid low by the Reagan farm crisis, which of course was an outgrowth of the S&L crisis. So there was a very direct sense in which I saw, I was only in my teens, so if that. And but it is true. I was back there for the first time in about 25 years over the last holidays. And Davenport is now sort of the riverboat gambling capital of the Upper Midwest, and there are a lot of socialists associated with that. And every day, my sister and I would drive by a billboard in downtown Moline that had the legend, need holiday cash, turn in a drug dealer, and would give a 1-800 number. So that is a sort
of... But they paid bounties?
Yeah. For meth and, any sort of drug dealer, but, you know, there's a lot of meth, lots of opioids. So it's a story of, small piece of the larger story of,
Was your family progressive, or are you rebelling against your family?
No, I am not a rebel. Both my parents were sort of traditional. My mother was a second wave feminist, founded a battered women's shelter and a women's counseling house hotline. And my father was sort of traditional post-war liberal, active in civil rights and other things. So.
Okay.
So yeah, I mean, that was also a weird, I remember my first job, out of college, I got an internship at Mother Jones, and I didn't really understand the whole idea of a liberal elite because my politics were not an elite affiliation. I got nothing in return for being a liberal at that time in that part of the country. But it was only when I started at Mother Jones that the penny dropped and I sort of saw, oh, these are the people.
No, wait, elaborate on that.
These are the liberal elites. Without going too much into my, sordid career history. In my class of interns, there was a person who descended from a major investment banking family. There was someone who was related to the person who ran the writer's retreat for Adam Hochschild, the publisher of the magazine.
Right.
There was someone who was the daughter of a star architect who Deirdre English, editor of the magazine, was dating. And then there was me. So there was like a very clear, like, one of these things is not like the other moment. Yeah, so I do come from, I'm also unlike, the recent TNR has had a long line of Ivy League grads in senior positions. I'm actually a high school dropout. So I have a very different, it's just a different social background.
I'm tempted to ask about the context of your dropping out of high school. You did go on to apparently get all the way to graduate school.
I did, yes. I got a GED, and then I actually sort of went about it backwards. I enrolled in a community college when I was still 16, and then I got a GED after I got my associate's degree and had to transfer.
It's funny. I feel I kind of identify with you. I mean, not that anybody asked, but I did actually graduate. Oh. I did actually graduate from Princeton, but I transferred there from TCU.
Where did you grow up? Texas?
Well, my father was in the Army, so he grew up all over. But my parents are both from West Texas farm families,
right.
Southern Baptist. And, I was the first, I was like the fourth child and the first sibling to graduate from college.
Right.
So I relate to that. So did this shape your, do you identify with that part of Trumpism, the resentment of liberal elites?
And at some level, I went to graduate school with Christopher Lash, who wrote The Revolt of the Elites, which Steve Bannon, in my view, grossly distorted and cited as a major influence on him in the Trump movement. I do have a suspicion of wonkery of the idea of an expert class that can kind of, in an enlightened way, engineer our ways out of our social problems. I think we need movements. We need ordinary people to feel included in a very direct way that they have a stake in society. And we have drifted away, I think, from that model of politics. That's why I do, even though the term is embattled right now, I consider myself a left populist in that sense.
Okay. Now I'm going to pause to ask you if you can tilt your camera up or something so that we can see the, exactly. Like your eyes.
All right, the top of my head.
Excellent. Okay. So, when somebody takes over an esteemed publication like the New Republic, people ask them, like, what are you going to do with it? And this happened to you, I don't know, 5 months ago or something? How long is it?
It was a staggered process. I took over on a consulting basis in late January. Uh-huh. There was an sort of an ongoing search for a permanent editor, and eventually I became the subject of that, or the whatever.
You pulled a Dick Cheney. You pulled a Dick Cheney.
No, that's what
he was in charge of the vice presidential search committee or something, and he said, "I've got an idea. How about me?"
Right. He put himself forward. I never did that. I'm a Midwesterner. I would never do that.
You would never do that.
No. But it did work out that I got the gig permanently and started officially in that capacity in April. So yeah, it's still new.
Uh-huh. And so anyway, people ask you this, and right. You should by now have a stock answer, right? That's like road tested to like sound good.
Yeah, I'm still working on it, to be honest. I'm not exactly facile with talking
bullshit.
Points.
You're not good at bullshit?
Well, it depends. If we're drinking and you know the night wears on, definitely. But now part of my talking point is what I was saying earlier. This might be your great grandfather's New Republic and the urgent issues that called the magazine into being when Herbert Crowley and Lippmann et al. Founded it haven't changed in a fundamental way. They were, they were exercised about how do you, make a burgeoning industrial capitalist economy more democratic? Does a new population of immigrants participate meaningfully in the American democratic experiment? And how, do the forces of democratic reform embrace what Crowley saw as the Hamiltonian project, right? You want to harness Hamiltonian means to Jeffersonian ends was his formula, which I think on inspection, I don't think it worked out that way historically. I think there's still some promise for that, but I think we have to, there is a democracy deficit in this country right now. And what we're seeing is a perversion of, we have a, billionaire, a self-styled billionaire president who's probably lying about his fortune, but certainly he is the mouthpiece of an oligarchy that wants to depict itself as populist, as representing the people I grew up with in Iowa, and many of them are responding. Mm-hmm. But the challenge for us, people of goodwill on the left, broadly speaking, is to reconstruct our politics so it speaks to the plight of those same people in a non-racist, non-xenophobic, insane fashion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, actually, I mean, thinking about it, you're actually pretty well suited to this job by background. I mean, you know the territory, so to speak.
Yeah.
And let me ask you a question that I hadn't actually planned to ask you, but what do you think of the way the quote resistance has been handling its business to the extent that it's possible to generalize? Of course, lots of people have said they're part of the resistance. I think the term isn't used as often as it was for a while, but you know what I mean, kind of, right?
I think it's, it's become sort of a, in my more cynical moments, I think of it as a social media brand, right? Hashtag resistance. There's no, Philip Robb used to say, former editor of the Partisan Review at the height of the New Left, he said he didn't believe that there was a New Left until someone gave him its mailing address. And I think we have the same problem with the idea of the resistance. It's not clear to me who the leaders are. There were organizers of the Women's March who turned out to have a certain ugly sensibilities in other spheres. We have, in my view, I was thinking about this earlier today. We have a Democratic congressional leadership that's, just being ultra risk averse, conflict averse, thinking that they can just carry the ball across the finish line in November with a big, set of promises that they'll continue expanding coverage of pre-existing conditions. I think that's a serious leadership crisis. And I think it does, going back to your question about liberal elites, Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer come from two of the safest, you know, ultra blue Democratic, you know, I know Schumer's statewide, but he basically represents Manhattan, I think part of Queens and part of a little bit of Long Island when he was in the House, and, or Brooklyn too, that's right. Anyway, I think there is this weird sort of Stockholm syndrome that has seized these people, that they look out at, you know, these disaffected laid off manufacturing workers or whoever else at Trump rallies, and they're terrified. They don't really understand who these people are. They think, you know, first thought is they're racist, which is not wrong, obviously, or that they are.
Let me drill down on that a little. Yes. You mean when they, who is the they that is racist? And
well, that they are, you know, the hardcore Trump supporters, the people who the New York Times obsessively interviews over and over again to make sure they still support Trump. A friend of mine calls that journalistic project a Cletus Safari, referencing the character on The Simpsons. And I do think there's a tendency both to exoticize and to fear those people as though they're, you know, they somehow have seized control of our politics and you can't do anything about, you know, when I reviewed Hillary Clinton's 2016 campaign memoir, What Happened, she has this extended vignette where she goes to West Virginia, where she pissed off a bunch of workers by saying the coal industry was just going to have to die off.
Right.
And she's sitting there, or she's outside of a court or a campaign event there, and people are booing her, and they're standing next, I'm going to space on the guy, the coal miner owner who is going to run for Senate and had been sent to jail. Blankenship, I think his name is. Anyway, if it's not Blankenship, I apologize to anyone named Blankenship out there. And she just makes the leap as she describes her reaction to the scene of like, well, all these people, you know, they're not going to support, you know, my program to whatever, create job trainings or, you know, bring tech back to rural America, blah, 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 because they're standing next to this coal miner and, you know, as though they all belong to the same social class. That is, that vignette spoke a lot to me about this problem. There's a tendency to just have a very broad brush understanding of who exactly lives and works in so-called middle America, and to see them as politically hopeless if you're a liberal. And again, when I was growing up, there were liberals all over who represented the islands in the Senate. There were, you know, there weren't a lot in my neighborhood. It's true, but, it was not, by any means a moribund political tradition, and there were people who were, you know, who made it work politically, and I think we've lost sight of that tradition as a result of the Trump, whatever you call it.
So what, how does this kind of cash out in terms of what strategy / ideology you think can be effective? I mean, in a way, the take-home version of the question is which of the presidential candidates is best suited to beat Trump. But although that kind of, there's another dimension added.
So
let's start out with the ideology strategy. Kind of, if you were just, suppose there weren't any presidential candidates yet,
right,
and you were just going to create one in central casting,
right,
and these views and maybe this profile, based on your, you know, your considered reflection, but also your actual firsthand experience in middle America, what would you say is needed to maximize the chances of beating Trump?
Well, I'm still, chaotically, I think I'm in the draft Sherrod Brown movement.
I'm with you, man.
Yeah. I don't know why he elected not to run. I mean, right now, the biggest economic issue, I think, that's going to cut through the primaries is trade. And he is so much better than, you know, even someone like Bernie.
Is he better than Bernie? In other words, we mean left. So he is.
Right.
Sherrod Brown is interesting because on the one hand, he doesn't freak people out with socialist vibes, but he is an economic nationalist historically, which is the card that Trump played so successfully.
Right. And he has the credentials. I think, you know, I think Bernie voted against NAFTA on ideological grounds, which is fine. But I think Sherrod Brown understood that this was going to, you know, gut his constituency, which is a different kind of response. And again, we're talking about what's politically possible. I think, Sherrod Brown just would take away, you know, and his wife, Connie Schultz, is an amazing figure as well. You know, there's just a very, in my mind, you know, it's a populist version of what, you know, we had promised, we might have been promised in 1992.
Right.
Someone holding statewide office in a, you know, what had been a sort of deindustrializing, and downwardly mobile in parts state, and has a sort of demonstrated track record and a vision for how to get out of that. That's an incredibly powerful narrative.
Yeah. So he didn't, he wound up not running. So anyway, ideologically, you'd like to see an economic nationalist,
slash populist. I think nationalist is another one of those words that's been sort of, you know, this is another big part of our problem is we have outmoded political language as in addition to outmoded political ideas. I don't think nationalism is itself objectionable. I think all nations have self-interest and certainly economic self-interest. But I also think, you know, it shades off very easily into ethnic or racial tribalism. So you have to be a little careful with all of these terms.
I mean, there's also the fact that in principle, you can use something like NAFTA to actually pursue with sufficiently strong labor provisions. You can imagine using a multinational trade agreement to actually pursue the interests of workers.
Which is sort of how it was sold, but I think it was sold disingenuously. What's interesting, I was also thinking when Ross Perot died recently, like, and I do edit a national magazine, I should have been quicker on the uptake here, but I was thinking someone should do a piece arguing Ross Perot was right. You know, I remember, you know, the big debate he had with Al Gore about NAFTA, and everyone just sort of, you know, everyone in sort of the pundit consensus at that time thought Al Gore just humiliated Perot. And I think, you know, it's not so clear now.
It's funny. I didn't think it was so clear at the time, but that you're right about the consensus. I mean, I watched the debate, and I wasn't on Perot's side particularly at the time. But
no, I wasn't either. I thought,
but I thought so. I was kind of rooting for Gore, but it wasn't clear to me he'd won. But then everybody said he had won, and the rest is history. And in those days, I mean, we had said we'd do a little contrasting with the past. In those days, elite consensus was almost a more definite thing and a more influential thing, and something easier to wrap. You know, it's like you could read what five columnists said the next day and go, okay, that's the elite consensus, and it's more complicated now.
Yeah, I mean, obviously organs of news gathering and opinion have multiplied exponentially, and I do think, you know, the Iraq war happened, the 2008 meltdown happened. Objectively, there's not a great deal of cause to instinctively place your trust in these people.
Well, let me ask you about that, because on that debate, I was on the right side, I'm happy to say. Actually, nobody at the New Republic was. Now, I had drifted away. I had left the New Republic. I guess I was still a contributing editor, so it wasn't the milieu I was any longer in. But I was writing regularly for Slate, but almost everyone at Slate was also for the Iraq War. I gather that if you compare the New Republic's foreign policy, pre-Iraq War foreign policy, dating back certainly to the time I was actually there physically in Washington at the New Republic, you compare, to the extent that I can read the tea leaves, the foreign policy ideology of the New Republic that you're running is appreciably different. I mean, the New
Republic, I think that's fair.
It was almost crypto neocon at the time when I was there.
Right.
And sometimes not so crypto. I mean, they let me write what I wanted to write, but the drift, it was like Marty Peretz, the owner, exerted a lot of influence on that. And Mike Kinsley, the editor, would give him a certain amount of, you know, leeway. They would, you know, but it was kind of a, very hawkish, and all the way up to the war, support of the war. What's your foreign policy?
Well, I think this is another sphere in which, you know, events have overtaken ideology. Like I just assigned, a piece on the death of the twilight of the neocons. I was struck, obviously, I at least can't identify anything you would call a Trump doctrine. I don't see correspondingly much.
I'm sorry. I didn't hear you identify what?
Much in the way of a Trump doctrine on the right. It seems, trade is an element, but it's far from coherent. And, there are all of these sort of, it's a reality TV model, I think, of foreign policy over there. And there isn't a lot more coherence on the other side. I think Democrats, there's a lingering humanitarian intervention position from the Obama / Hillary / Samantha Power regime, but there's, not much consensus there, especially as the I hesitate to call it the Democratic base. I don't know what the Democratic base is anymore, but there's a sense that the voters in the party are moving left, and there's certainly a lot of impatience with the track record of interventionists for good reason. I was like you, I moved to Washington right before 9/11, and the week of the attacks, I went to dinner at Christopher Hitchens's apartment, and this is when he was still at the Nation, before the big, falling out, right? And no one in the Bush administration had begun talking about Iraq at this point. So again, like 5 or 6 days after the attack, a number of other people are there. Grover Norquist is there, which baffled me at the time.
He's actually pretty good on foreign policy, isn't he?
In a libertarian sort of way, he can be. He wasn't this night, is my point. He and Hitchens adjourned to the far end of the table and polished off a bottle of Johnny Walker Black and talked only about the need to invade Iraq now.
Is that right?
I was completely befuddled because, again, no one, Dick Cheney, no one, Rumsfeld, none of these people from the Bush administration had said a word about Iraq. And I took, the position that I tended to take throughout that time of like, I think it's a crime, not an act of war, but if you're going to prosecute it as an act of war, 18 of the 19 hijackers came from Saudi Arabia. Right? Like, if you're going to do the blood and soil routine. And they just laughed and said, you're so naive. And in a sense, they were right. I was. That was a sort of big welcome to Washington moment for me.
That was amazing. I mean, that was like just living in the Matrix or something. I mean, the run-up to the Iraq War was like, I remember when Bush was demanding that they let the UN inspectors in or we would invade, basically.
Right. And then we did.
And then finally he let the inspectors in. And I thought, oh, well, I guess I have to acknowledge that there was, it was kind of successful what Bush did. And now we won't invade. But they were just not to be denied. It made no impact on the momentum toward war that he caved and did what they demanded. It was unbelievable. And all my liberal friends at Slate and the New Republic were on board. It was totally bizarre.
No, my other 9/11 related memory or Iraq war memory was I was then working at the Washington Post and, the newsroom stood still while Colin Powell gave his address to the UN, allegedly documenting the WMD threat. And to a person, everyone around me pronouncing people in the home section, were suddenly saying that's it. We got to go invade. And it was a very disorienting, how did I end up here at this moment? I don't understand anything that's happening around me.
And it's like, I took him at his word. I mean, it turned out that Powell was wrong about a lot of stuff, but I assumed he was right and still didn't think it made sense to invade.
Right. And whatever, but yeah.
The rest is history. And so it's been, we're reckoning with that. And there is more and more, there's this, this think tank taking shape, the Quincy Institute, right. Which is will be an interesting kind of anti-militarism think tank, the first one I know of in Washington in a way.
Apart from like IPS, the traditional lefty, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Right. And I noticed you had I mentioned this in my newsletter, you had this piece by Daniel Besner, the review of Samantha Power's book. You know, you compare it with what the New York Times did with Samantha Power's book. Right. They assigned it to Tom Friedman, and we get the predictable endorsement as opposed to kind of pointing out kind of how disastrous some of the policies she supported have been. So anyway, I take it that is indicative of where you're heading on foreign policy.
Yeah, I think, and you know, with the caveat that it's still, as American foreign policy debate is right now, very much a work in progress. But yeah, we certainly aren't as interventionist minded as predecessor regimes at CNR have been. Mm-hmm. And you know, it's the same in political economy. Speaking of the 2008 meltdown, I will briefly tout the cover story for our October issue, which is on the Boeing 737 MAX fiasco.
Right.
And it's a very deep dive into the history of the management culture at Boeing, how engineers got sidelined, how it became a sort of holding company for return on net assets models of investment, as opposed to sort of considered, you know, put a plane together, take it back apart when you find something wrong and fix it. And I will note there was a cover story in the New York Times Sunday Magazine that took the diametrically opposite position, that it was all pilot error in this case. So here's a chance for readers, you know, we report, let readers decide.
So as for like what it's like to put something like the New Republic out these days, you know, when I was there, it was a true weekly magazine.
Right.
And I mean, I remember like when I was acting editor, we'd close on Thursday night. I'd like be, you know, close to dead, go out to dinner with my wife. The next day was like actually fun. We'd have an editorial meeting. There's no pressure.
Right. And then it all starts up. I'm used to that metabolism. Actually, I've worked in a lot of newspapers. Obviously the Baffler was an exception, but, like the pace of a weekly publication, but for various reasons having to do with both Chris Hughes and the, you know, tenor of our industry generally, we're a monthly now. So it does make, you know, I envy you the ability to be quicker on the news.
Well, but you're also a daily, right? I mean, online, that's kind of what I was getting at was you know, I was thinking maybe you never feel okay. I can take a few days off.
It can be hard, definitely, but it's also exhilarating. You know, and we have, you know, it's the nice thing is you and I are older, but there's a generation of journalists who are just sort of digital native and understand, you know, the metabolism and pace. And, you know, if anything, I want to kind of strike a, you know, as I was saying earlier, I think there's a great interest in more textured, nuanced and considered writing than you typically encounter online. So I'm trying to make our, if it makes sense to put it this way, our online presence more magazine-y. So you're doing, you know, traditional magazine features that just happen to be on the web.
Right.
We'll see how far we can go on that path.
So, but how are you handling the pressure to, I mean, that's a nice thing if you can do it, but in news game, I mean, I was, I blogged for a year at the Atlantic a few years ago, like, I don't know, it's now been 7 years or something. And I realized that at that point, at least, and of course the blog per se has kind of, arguably died, but anyway, I think the game I realized at that point was like, When news happens, what's the minimal amount of value you can add and still say you added some? Because that's the that's the fastest way to get something out, right? So it's like, here's the one spin I'm putting on this. Aside from that, I'm just rewriting the news, but we get it out. half an hour before our competitors, and so it rises and goes. I mean, that's very much a pressure, right?
Yeah, but there are also, in my mind, you know, obvious sort of red flags along that path. You know, there's a certain publication across the Potomac with the initials Politico that, you know, had the slogan, win the morning. I don't want to win the morning. I want to, you know, anything I say here is going to sound pretentious, but, you know, I want people to think differently. I want to win, you know, brain cells. And I want, you know, I want people to not feel inundated. I want them to feel like there's, you know, sort of a voice that is in their head that is not making them crazy. Mm-hmm. It's reminding them, you know, a certain, you know, again, Crowley-esque, you know, themes of what we're doing now. We want to, you know, make, you know, a political economy dominated by digital monopoly more democratic. We want to figure out how to make trade something that benefits, you know, more than the 1%. These are living political questions that we want to address, you know, we want to address the news cycle, but with those larger, you know, whatever you want to call them, mission statements or themes guiding what we write. So we'll see. It is, as I keep saying, Herbert Crowley himself said the magazine was an experiment. So it's a work in progress.
Now, how would you compare it to the Baffler? I mean, does the...
The Baffler is very... the Baffler is a weird... There's nothing like the Baffler out there, which is why I love the Baffler. It was a labor of love that I sort of caught into back when I was in Chicago working at In These Times and was editing and writing for it basically for free. And, you know, it came out of Gen X discontent. It was informed by a punk rock sensibility, and still in many ways is. It's gone on to do a lot of really ambitious, important stuff that I'm very proud of. But it's, obviously the New Republic has a very different legacy behind it. And I am very mindful of that. I am trained as a historian. I don't want to, you know, turn TNR into the Baffler. That would never work.
Right.
It would look super weird from the outside too. But I do think, you know, the Baffler did revive a certain kind of spirited cultural polemic that I think can have a home in TNR. That some of my favorite TNR pieces are in that vein, stuff actually that you've written, that Jim Walcott has written, that, Tom Gagan, who's doing a piece for me in the next issue, has written. I think there is that tradition at TNR too. So mm-hmm. We just bring it into more. And the other piece of this is the irony of this job is it's the only time my graduate education has actually proved useful, because I studied under Lash, the civic Republican revisionist thesis in American history. And that is very much what Wynne McCormick, our present donor, is very much engaged with. He writes a monthly column on the civic Republican tradition and how it fits into the debate of the Green New Deal, or how it fits into the, you know, larger debates about the future of liberalism. And that is, I think, a very distinctive, it's definitely different from the old TNR, because Alexander Hamilton is not a hero in that tradition, but I think it's a very strong, recoverable intellectual tradition. I'm eager to see the magazine inculcate and extend.
Mm-hmm. And what about kind of the tone of the magazine? I mean, you know, you go back and read the early New Republic, and it's so high gravitas and somber, and it's like, you know, Walter Lippmann making these Olympian pronouncements. Then you go up to the Kinsley era, and it's almost like a cerebral version of the David Letterman show. That's carrying it too far, but there was a common kind of almost postmodern meta sensibility about the New Republic then. And it was, you know, it was funny. Mike was a very funny guy.
Oh, sure.
And it was very tart and pointed in its criticisms of, like, we had a lot of fun making fun of George H.W. Bush and so on.
Yeah.
And one reason I ask about the Baffler is then, you know, how much of, do you see yourself as importing much of the Baffler's time. I mean, do any of them, I assume none of these are like the model for you. Do you have in your head like a New Republic?
I just lost your audio. I heard you just now. You may have just.
Okay. The question, maybe everyone else lost it. The question was, do you have in mind a kind of like a New Republic tone, like what the voice of the magazine should sound like?
I do, and it's not a complete vision. I do think, you know, like, this is sort of out of left field, I guess, but Edmund Wilson's Classics and Commercials anthology is all reviews he wrote when he was at TNR, and there's, for my money, some of the best sort of popular yet, you know. And, you know, he was in many ways an inspiration of the Baffler. It is true that I've named our weekly newsletter for subscribers American Jitters after Edmund Wilson's book about the Depression. So I think the Edmund Wilson tradition is, even though he was very much a Princeton guy and elite, but he had an interesting, he embodied an interesting highbrow yet populist sensibility that I certainly respond to as a reader and would love to see the magazine, you know. Obviously, I'm not saying, you know, there are no more Edmund Wilsons, but I think there are ways to reclaim that kind of tradition. And I think we're actually pretty well situated to do that. I think, in some ways, I'm reluctant to say this to an alum, and I have no love for Chris Hughes, but I think Chris Hughes did bequeath to me some, you know, there are many more open spaces at CNR right now. And I think we can populate those spaces with really interesting voices that haven't, you know, necessarily been heard in the sort of main run of liberal debate.
Okay.
And
so,
yes, I want those voices to be funny. I that is something I admire, you know, both about Michael Kinsley and I regard as a big legacy of the Baffler. We brought humor to the left when absolutely no one on the left was interested in being funny. I think that is a very important, it's just an essential element of great journalism. And I think it also gives readers, especially, you know, we are living in a bleak time, and it's important to laugh.
Okay. So when you say you left, we should say Chris Hughes, of course, is the previous owner of the magazine. He was Mark Zuckerberg's roommate at Harvard, and the rest is history. He wound up with enough money to buy the New Republic. But in what sense did he leave you? What do you mean when you say he kind of let in his wake there are open spaces?
Yeah, I just feel like, you know, that as you were saying earlier, the idea of the tradition of the magazine can be at times suffocating.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, I don't mean, you know, it is true that a bunch of people walked out over his, I'm not saying that, but I'm saying I think it's fair to say he did not steer the magazine in any coherent direction.
Right.
And from that point, I think I have a good point of departure to experiment again.
See what you mean. So he kind of, it's not like he left you with this high gravitas, very monolithic, homogeneous New Republic tradition.
Right.
He had already cast that aside. It's not clear what he planned to put in its place, but it was no longer this burden on you.
Right, exactly. And there are obviously, plus there are people I would love, you know, to bring back from that era who may not want to return. But but it is, you know, I am finding the sort of venerable past part of this job is I was frankly intimidated by that when I first came on. And it's still in my head, definitely, but it doesn't govern the day-to-day operations in the way that I thought it might.
Well, it sounds like you're well positioned to sustain the part of the legacy we're sustaining.
I hope so.
And I think honestly, you're a lot more in touch with it than Chris was, frankly. I mean, not that you're, you know, it's, you guys aren't comparable. You're not the owner, but, that's all interesting. I think I have to ask you, people complain if I don't ask you about this controversy. And I have my own take on it, that if you don't have anything to say about it, I want to say something about it. But it's, so you ran this piece by this guy named Dale Peck on Pete Buttigieg that a lot of people thought was outrageous. It got into speculation about Buttigieg's sexual proclivities. Yeah. Dale Peck, I gather, is himself gay. Right. And what I wound up realizing was that there was a certain, if you were in a certain demographic and cultural milieu, you kind of like got what Dale Peck was up to and didn't find it offensive. Whereas if you weren't in that milieu and demographic, you're like, what the hell is this? Right. You wound up actually kind of taking the piece down or something. And of course you took heat for that too. I think that actually says something about this, the difference between this era and the earlier TNR era, and maybe I'll opine on that. But first, what is there anything, what's your standard thing to say about that?
Nothing. I will say, you know, at occasion, you know, that whole episode obviously was traumatic in many ways, and we, you know, handled standards and practices internally. We revised publication standards and are, you know, very clear on what should and should not be published going forward.
Yeah.
And that's all I'm going to say.
What I was going to say was, you know, when I was at the New Republic, you had a very coherent audience. It was people who either subscribed to the magazine or chose to get it. Their demographic and cultural milieu was a very much a known thing.
Right.
Whereas when you put something out on the web and it gets picked, it could get picked up by any sector of the universe, any demographic sector, any ideological sector, and they could wind up making a big deal of it. So it's like, and that's just a very different world to be in. And as you know, a more complicated one.
That is certainly true. And that's what we've learned.
Yeah. So. So finally, I said, you know, you don't have to get into, which presidential candidate embodies your ideas about the ideology that's best suited to carry the day against Trump, or the ideology that you most want to carry the day. But are you saying anything about which candidate or which candidates you think are either ideologically laudable or politically problematic or anything else?
TNR institutionally?
Well, either one. I mean, what is your view? And also, now TNR, that's an interesting question. TNR dropped the editorial before you got there, right?
Yeah. And it's a monthly magazine now. It doesn't really feel appropriate to the rhythm of a monthly magazine. We've discussed whether we wanted to bring it back, and it was briefly revived under John Boole. It's complicated. I understand, you know, I guess past regimes endorsed both Al Gore and Joe Lieberman. And I kind of feel like that, again, came out of a different time where people did expect TNR to use a term I don't like, a thought leader, a journal of opinion that was going to tell people what to do and think. I think, you know, it behooves us right now, especially in a really unstable and disorienting political moment. You know, I don't think we're going to put all our chips behind candidate X or Y and say, you know, this is the road to salvation. It doesn't feel like it's more than whatever is involved with our reputation and name. It just doesn't feel like appropriate to this moment. I feel like I would be lying to myself if I were to say something like that. You know what I mean?
And you don't want to talk about your own personal favorite or least favorite or anything?
I really don't have, you know, like I said earlier, I'm in the draft shared brand camp. I think, you know, Sanders has productively moved the conversation in really important ways. I am not sure, you know, it's a very different field than the one he faced in 2016. I think Elizabeth Warren has, you know, really good ideas, and, you know, some that aren't so great, you know, and, you know, I like Mayor Pete as well. I think he's actually rhetorically said some really good stuff. I think he's weak on healthcare policy and other stuff. So yeah, I don't really have, you know, that's why I think the first rule of journalism is to tell the truth. And, you know, like the truth I have to tell about this campaign is I don't know.
Have you done the draft Sherrod Brown piece?
No. You want to write it?
Do it. What?
I said, you want to write it?
I'm not so well equipped. Yeah. I think maybe a, conceivably like a John Judas or somebody would be. But I think it could be an important piece. If only, I was going to ask, do you share my unease about the current crop of candidates in political terms? I mean, there's some of them I'd be happy to have them as president. It just seems like none of them are really designed to beat Trump. And if nothing else, a kind of a draft Sherrod Brown piece would be a way of discussing that issue.
Right. To get it, out there, if it doesn't result in drafting Sherrod Brown, it might make more candidates a bit more like Sherrod Brown.
Right. So this is the thought I leave you with, and I'm not going to charge for it.
All right.
My consulting is free. Tell me, as we say goodbye to our audience, is there, we mentioned your books.
Yeah.
The Money Cult and Rich People. What about, do you have a Twitter handle?
I do. @lehmanchris.com.
LEHMANN.
Chris. Yeah.
Uh huh. And yeah. I'm @RobertReiter, by the way. And yes. Any other web properties aside from TNR.com? And of course, they should follow TNR on Twitter.
Yes, absolutely. There's a TNR Facebook account if you're into that version of digital monopoly. But I've very much enjoyed talking about all this with you and it's been great.
Yeah. No, I'm pleased with what I'm hearing. I'm optimistic about the future of the very high gravitas institution.
From your lips to God's ears.
I'll see what I can do about that too. Okay. Yeah. Thanks a lot, Chris.
Thank you, Bob. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Before you go, a quick message from the suits at Blogging Heads TV. Blogging Heads will always be free for you to watch and listen to, and we don't even go the NPR route of guilting you into donating during Pledge Week. But we do have a small request. If you enjoy Blogging Heads programming, rate and review us on iTunes. The iTunes algorithm weighs positive reviews heavily, so taking a few minutes to rate and review us will help more people find out about our shows. Also, of course, we encourage you to subscribe to our Twitter and Facebook feeds. Thank you.